Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tom Wack. I'm the president of the Judicial Learning Center. This is a big event. The Freedom Riders traveling exhibition, which I would invite all of you to see if you haven't already, is located on the third floor of this building. It was developed by the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History in partnership with American Experience, and major funding for the traveling exhibition is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities. While you're in the building, you might also want to visit the Learning Center itself, which is on the first floor. And if you like it and you have children who are in school, tell the schools about it and have them come down. We think it's a very positive thing for our community. We have three distinguished speakers, but before we get to that, I would like to talk a little bit about the events in question. Some of us weren't around in 1961, and those of us who were may not remember. So here it is. At 7:45 p.m. on Monday, July 10, 1961, a bus bound for Houston carrying five Freedom Riders pulled into Little Rock's Midwest Trailway Station at Markham and Louisiana Streets. The Freedom Riders were all on a sponsored journey by the St. Louis branch of the Civil Rights Organization, CORE, from St. Louis to New Orleans to test certain court-ordered desegregation in trailways, bus, and Illinois Central Railroad terminal facilities. The rider's journey had begun that morning with an itinerary that wound from St. Louis to Little Rock, then on to Shreveport, finally on to New Orleans with a planned return leg by train through Mississippi, Tennessee, and Illinois, arriving back in St. Louis on Sunday, July 16th. The head of the CORE Freedom Riders group was 39-year-old Reverend Benjamin Elton Cox, a native of Tennessee and a minister at Pilgrim Congregational Church in High Point, North Carolina. He was a veteran of the very first Freedom Ride, which had been held in May earlier that year. His fellow riders were Bliss Ann Malone, a public school teacher from St. Louis, Annie Lumpkin, a student from St. Louis, then 27-year-old John Raines, a pastor from Setauket Methodist Church in Long Island, and Janet Reinitz, a artist and homemaker from New York City. In December 1958, Bruce Boynton, a Howard University law student, had been arrested for refusing to leave the white section of a bus terminal restaurant in Richmond, Virginia, while on interstate bus journeys from Washington to Alabama. When his case reached the U.S. Supreme Court on appeal, the court extended its earlier Morgan ruling to include the desegregation of interstate transportation terminal facilities as well as interstate carriers. James Farmer, National Director of CORE, proposed to revisit an earlier journey of reconciliation after the Morgan ruling with a, quote, freedom ride to test the new law at Southern bus terminals. The five St. Louis CORE Freedom Riders headed to Little Rock on one of a number of further freedom rides held in the summer of 1961, aimed at testing bus terminal facilities across the South and keeping the issue in the headlines. News of their arrival, which was publicized in advance, had already provoked discussion and debate in the city. The bus company said it would make no special provision for the riders' arrival. Little Rock Police Chief Robert Glasscock ambiguously stated that his men would uphold law and order. Governor Faubus, who had made international headlines in 1957, when he had called out the Arkansas National Guard to prevent the desegregation of Little Rock Central High School, was questioned by the press about the rioters' imminent arrival, and Faubus simply ignored them, stating that it would be the worst disappointment they could have. The advance warning of the rioters' arrival encouraged a crowd of about 300 to 400 people, many teenage boys and girls, to gather at the Midwest Trailways bus station. At first, people began to line up on a wooden catwalk on Louisiana Street across from the bus station. And as the crowd grew, it spread out onto the sidewalk in front of the Hotel Marion on Markham Street. Police Chief Glasscock cruised the area in a patrol car with two uniformed officers, five plainclothes policemen surrounded him. The crowd was largely silent in anticipation, but as the time drew near for the arrival of the rioters' bus, a crush of cars and people in the area ratcheted up the tension. A crowd of white people were ready for a confrontation, and despite efforts by a leading group of leading Little Rock businessmen urging calm, the city police chief declined to disperse the crowd and instead arrested the rioters. And so that's the background. Dr. Raines, who was there, I'm sure can tell us more about it and what happened after that. Our first speaker today is the Honorable Frankie Muse Freeman. Ms. Freeman is well known in St. Louis. She was born in Danville, Virginia, attended undergraduate school at Hampton University, legal training at Howard. She moved to St. Louis in 1948 and opened her own solo law practice in 1949. She practiced law continuously from 1948 to her retirement in 2009. By my count, that is 61 years. 61 years practicing law. President Johnson nominated Ms. Freeman to become the first woman to serve as a commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She served in that position until 1980. During the Carter administration, she served as Inspector General of the Community Services Administration. In 1982, she joined 15 other former high federal officials who formed a bipartisan Citizens Commission on Civil Rights. She began her career serving the state of Missouri and the city of St. Louis. And during those years, the early years of her practice, she helped the NAACP in the case of Bruton versus Board of Education of St. Louis, and later represented the NAACP in the landmark case of Davis versus the St. Louis Housing Authority, which ended legal racial discrimination in public housing here. Ms. Freeman has received numerous accolades for her life's work, including a number of honorary degrees, induction into the National Bar Association's Hall of Fame, the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame. She is a recipient of the NAACP's Spin Guard Medal, which is highly coveted, and she is past chair of the board of directors of the National Council on the Aging, and she serves on the executive committee of the St. Louis NAACP and many other organizations. Let's welcome Frankie Freeman.
Good afternoon. It is a pleasure and honor to have been invited to share this afternoon, to share the tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King at the same time that you're having the exhibit of the Freedom Riders. This birthday of Martin Luther King is on the same occasion as the Freedom Riders exhibit has historical significance because of the dedication of young black and white men and women exhibited by risking their lives to challenge racial discrimination, segregated facilities, and also supporting the work and efforts of Dr. Martin Luther King. I knew Dr. King. He was a great American, a visionary force, an eloquent and profound interpreter of the needs of the people. He fought hard and endlessly for the simple recognition of the dignity of all human beings. The apostle of nonviolence was the victim of many acts of violence, including the final striking down in Memphis, because he dared to live and work for freedom. In 1964, he accepted the Nobel Prize for Peace and said, quote, "I accept this award on behalf of a civil rights movement which is moving with a determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice," close quote. At the 1963 March on Washington, he painted his dream, quote, "I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. With this faith, we shall be able to work together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will all be free one day," close quote. In Memphis, Tennessee, on April 3rd, 1968, he said, "We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter to me now because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind." On the following day, an assassin silenced him forever. In my final quote from Dr. King, I would like to relate what he said on September 1963 in his eulogy for the four little girls who were killed in the Birmingham church bombing. I'd like to relate that to his own death, and I quote, "The children died nobly, and in their death carried message for the living. They say to each of us, black and white alike, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, and the philosophy which produced the murderers. Their death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly to make the American dream a reality." The eulogy of 1963, adapted to his assassination in April 1968, is even more poignant today as we observe the anniversary of his birth. The gap between the American promise of equal opportunity and equal justice under the law and its inadequate fulfillment in practice has been a major factor in American history from the beginning of the nation. The conflict between those who would extend the Republican principle to all persons and those who would delay its application is with us still. Today is a time for celebration of the birth of Martin Luther King and his courageous leadership. But this is also a time for sober reflection and assessment. I have been involved in the struggle for civil rights, equal opportunity, and the elimination of discrimination and prejudice for many, many years. In March 1964, as you heard, President Lyndon Johnson nominated me as the first woman to serve as a commissioner of the six-member U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. This was a period of intense civil rights activities throughout the nation. Dr. Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders were protesting racial discrimination and denial of voting rights, which was pervasive throughout the South. In February 1965, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights held a public hearing in Jackson, Mississippi, and on the basis of testimony at that hearing, we issued a report to the President and the Congress, and three of the Commission's recommendations were included in the Voting Rights Act, signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson in August 1965. As a result of the Voting Rights Act, more blacks who were denied the right to vote became involved, stayed involved, and were elected to public office. In 2008, President Barack Obama was elected the 44th President of the United States. I attended his inauguration. He was reelected on November 6, 2012, and I'm going back to Washington to attend that inauguration. We have made progress, but the struggle continues. And the president needs all of our help. Each of us should recognize our individual responsibility, do our homework, become involved, stay involved, and work to make a difference. And so many times that I've given a speech, I've concluded with a poem which my mother sent to me many years ago. The author's unknown, but it says, "It shows on your face." You don't have to tell how you live each day. You don't have to say if you work or play. A tried true barometer serves in the place. So however you live, it shows on your face. The false, the deceit that you wear in your heart will not stay inside where it first gets its start. For sin and blood is just a vain, thin veil of lace. However you live, it shows on your face. If you have battled and won in this great game of life, if you feel you have conquered the sorrow of strife, you have played the game fair, and you stand on first base. You don't have to tell it. It shows on your face. If your life is unselfish and you live as you give, not for what you can get, but for what you can give. If you live close to God and His infinite grace, you don't have to tell it. It shows on your face. Martin Luther King, live close to God in His infinite grace, and it showed on his face. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Ajua Ayatoro. Some background here. In 2011, on the 50th anniversary of the journey itself, the University of Arkansas at Little Rock launched their Institute on Race and Ethnicity for the purpose of continuing the work of the Civil Rights Movement. The launch of the Institute included a celebration and commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders coming from St. Louis to Little Rock. The university and the institute have done extensive work to research and document this important event and its importance to the civil rights movement. Ms. Ayatoro is the inaugural director of the institute. She is also an associate professor of law at the university's William H. Bowdoin School of Law. She has extensive experience working domestically and internationally to obtain remedies for historical and present-day wrongs to people of color, women, and other oppressed groups. She has been a lawyer in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division and Director of Administration at the ACLU Foundation's National Prison Project. She is a lifetime member of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and has served on its board of directors as co-chairperson of its board and as its national director. She was born in St. Louis, went to Washington University, George Warren Brown School of Social Work as a graduate student, and began a career as a social worker. She worked to desegregate the maternity ward at Barnes Hospital, where Medicaid patients, most of whom were black, were relegated to the second floor and isolated during segregation. She attended law school at St. Louis University School of Law, and she is uniquely qualified to discuss the legal legacy of the Freedom Riders and the civil rights movement of the 1960s and how they apply to human rights struggles today. Ms. Ayatoro.
Thank you. I was waiting for him to say a graduate of the St. Louis University Law School. If he wasn't, I was going to say it. My professors are here. First of all, I'd like to thank Rachel and others for inviting me today. It's really an honor to be asked to speak today and be one of the speakers between these phenomenal people that I have so much respect for. I knew Attorney Freeman as I was growing up in St. Louis, and she's just somebody that has inspired so many, many of us to walk in her stead and stand up and speak truth. And of course, Dr. Raines, I met last year at the inaugural event for the Institute, but was also the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides coming to Little Rock and attempting to desegregate, he'll tell the story, the Trailways bus station. We sang together, our pictures in the newspaper, singing. So I really appreciate the invite. I feel that my legal credentials that I obtained from the St. Louis University School of Law, along with my MSW from Washington University George Warren Brown School of Social Work, were critical in my development as a justice advocate, with racial justice being one of my primary focuses. It's something that, pulled together things that I always felt in my heart, and it gave me the training, the leadership of professors and colleagues, and just the study, and the study of law gave me an insight that you perhaps aren't going to be surprised at what that insight is in a few minutes. But it was really helpful because what happens is as I have moved forward in my career and I look back over it and I say, man, I'm not that old, really. How did I do all this stuff? But I look back and I see how education combined with that thing in my heart, the thing in my spirit, to give me credibility. I got places because of my law degree. I got places because of MSW. And some of them you get places because they wouldn't hire me as a lawyer with the Department of Justice if I didn't have a law degree. And it gets that experience. But what it did was it also get me deeper and deeper into the bowels of the society and the ways in which racism continues to replicate itself. So one of the things that I've done as I talk to audiences, and in fact it happened again when Rachel asked me, except that over these years I've worked on freeing myself, and my theme really is freedom. The civil rights movement and the freedom riders were about freedom. But part of it has to be, and I think we heard it from Attorney Freeman, is that we have to free ourselves, too. It's an individual walk as well as a group walk. And part of that freeing of myself as a black woman, and I think both of those are significant, is freeing myself of this view that, maybe I won't be scholarly enough, or maybe I won't express myself as well, and all of those things, especially when I get up to speak in front of audiences that include lawyers and judges and my law professors. And, you think you're going to fall flat on your face. And what part of my freedom was is to recognize that I have in my heart and in my training the skills and the learning and the commitment to share whatever I'm going to share with you today, and that I don't have to be afraid that I might not say it in the way in which a judge or a professor, I am a professor now, so I have to worry about that, will say it. And when I say that, I'm giving kind of a personal testimony, because I think what Attorney Freeman said, and you all may have glossed over it, but freedom is both an individual and a group struggle, path, work. And if we're going to really be free as a society, we have to be able to look deeply into those things that may be holding us back. And I'm going to share some of those things as I see it in a few minutes. So my starting point today is the starting point of talking with you about how the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s that really included organizations such as CORE, and CORE was very active here. CORE was behind the Freedom Rides and others, not only here but across the country. And also organizations such as NAACP, the Freedom Rise that came through CORE, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, how their purposes, even though they may have been, the Freedom Riders were looking, say, specifically at public accommodations. Each of them may have, at different times, had a different focus, but they were all about making equality of treatment an opportunity, a reality for all, particularly in that era for black Americans. So although we see that the Freedom Riders' focus on public accommodations was one that has garnered them a tremendous amount of respect, you have to respect them when you see them being blown, the bus that they're riding on in Anniston, Alabama, being blown up and people trying to keep them in that bus to burn them alive. Even though we see that, it is clear that their underlying motivation and their underlying purpose was a deep commitment to the fundamental equality of all human beings, to freedom. Bernice Reagan of Sweet Honey and the Rock, who is now retired from Sweet Honey and the Rock, but her singing came out of the civil rights movement, out of the 60s in Mississippi and other places. She wrote a song that I think in many ways can be the anthem of the movement for freedom. It's called Ella Song, and it was written in honor of Ella Baker, who was a field secretary and leader of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And some of you have heard it. I'm not going to sing it. I can sing, but I'm not going to sing it. But it's a significant anthem because it says, "We who believe in freedom shall not rest until the life of a black man, black mother's son, is as important as the life of a white man, white mother's son. We who believe in freedom shall not rest." So what role has the law played in this quest for freedom? That freedom for black people or African Americans. I was on the plane. Oh, I can tell this story. Sitting on the window seat, and I'm on the aisle seat on the Southwest plane, is Charlie Pride. How many of y'all know Charlie Pride? I kept looking at him saying, I don't know who that guy is, but I know him. Well, one of the things that he said, which was significant when I told him how proud I used to be when he would be on these, I have to, you know, fess up, I used to listen to country music. And, you know, I would see these shows and there would be this black man, really top-notch black country singer. And he says, "You know, I started out as colored. Then I went to Negro. Then I went to black. Now I'm African-American." So the quest for us as people of African descent has been a quest to name ourselves to, right? A big quest. And so when we look at what the law has done to help in that or deter us, I'm going to speak candidly, in that quest, we have to start with when we were, in fact, those of us of African descent, our ancestors, began this trek in the United States or in the colonies as enslaved Africans, crammed into ships and brought to the colonies in the U.S., and for over 200 years, close to 250 years, were legally stripped of human rights by the laws of the U.S., the law. It was not a legal decision that ended slavery, but a war and legislative action, although there were individual cases where courts intervened and denied the white his or her claim to ownership of an individual. New York, cases in New York, Sojourner Truth is one of those cases, fighting for the freedom of her son, or a group of enslaved Africans on the ship, the Amistad, argued by John Adams. After the passage of the 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment, the law served largely to maintain a segregated society that saw blacks as being treated as less than whites. Famous cases are Plessy v. Ferguson and Dred Scott. Dred Scott happened right here, right? At least they began right here. We saw, however, the law, through the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, chip away at segregated schools, even in Missouri, until the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, which did two things. It overruled Plessy, and it held that segregated schools violated the Constitution. Now, when I say, I'm assuming many of you are lawyers and judges, but some of you may not. When I said overrule Plessy, Plessy was the famous case in 1896 that said separate but equal is fine, right? That you can have separate train cars and that's fine, that they're equal. Well, of course, we knew then and we know now that they weren't equal. Unfortunately, although the court ended the myth of separate but equal, the decision only increased the view that black children were inferior to white children by indicating that black children suffered by not being in schools with white children. It was another example of the white supremacist worldview being codified in case law. Indeed, it was not being prohibited from sitting next to white children that was the problem at all. It was the assumption made by the court and continued by the court, not the assumption made by the court, but continued by the court, that black children were inferior to whites and suffered by being denied the interaction with them that was the problem. The discrimination was, in fact, and the problem, serious problem, was, in fact, a discrimination and a denial of resources. That black children were in schools that had to read from secondhand books, books that had pages torn from them. Black children knew the names of all the white children in the school system. Why? Because their names are written in their books. It was the resources, the holes in the ceilings of schools, the desks that were inadequate, the teachers that were paid barely a living salary and that struggled to teach our children. And that one of the things that we see that the law did, not intentionally, and in fact some of the well-meaning lawyers that were on the legal team did, not intentionally, was to strip one of the true values that our children got from going to black schools. That was being taught by very educated black teachers with black principals in charge of the school. With the integration of the schools, what the law did unintentionally was strip students of significant role models. Black principals became teachers. Black teachers, some of them lost their jobs as we integrated the schools. So that the law acting, you know, did something good, but then maybe not so good. And that's not only my analysis, but some others, but others, of course, can and do disagree. So in a large sense, the declaration of the end of separate but equal was in fact just the beginning of another battle. We didn't see the harms, and I say we even though I was a child back then, but we didn't see the harms to black children of being forced to desegregate all white schools. I have friends and colleagues now in Arkansas that in fact were in the leadership of desegregating the schools. I know and call among my friends a couple of the Little Rock Nine. I have a colleague who was the first student to integrate Hall Junior High School. And they talk about the daily insults, physical and verbal assaults, and isolation that they endured while teachers and principals walked around it. White teachers and principals. In Central High School, the only reason we know beyond the stories told by the Little Rock Nine is that the guidance counselor, who was attempting in a kind of secretive way to support Elizabeth Eckford, who was daily, all of them were daily, you know, clothes, things thrown on her clothes, having to change clothes. She used to keep a change of clothes for the students. She kept a diary. And that diary was turned over to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. And that diary tells the abuses that those nine suffered for that year that they were in Central High before Governor Faubus closed all the schools and said, oh, we can't stand this. We're just going to close the schools. So that battle continued, though. Even after that 54, 55, 56, 57, all of those tumultuous years, you know, we look at the Brown v. Board of Education, and it said with all deliberate speed, and some of our states, I know Arkansas, and I think Missouri too, maybe, are still working on all deliberate speed. You know, they're still struggling over, and Arkansas definitely is, struggling over in the courts the issues of the desegregation of the schools. So the provision of equal resources to schools, regardless of race and economic status, has continued to take a back seat to desegregation. In fact, the Supreme Court in the United States has said it's not a right. Equal resources are not a constitutional right. And the Arkansas Supreme Court just this past year actually reversed itself when it used to say that the districts that had, the state could take excess funds for education from the districts that were, you know, more flush, had more money to distribute to the poor districts. And just this year, it reversed itself and said, no, the rich districts can keep their money. And just yesterday, was it yesterday on the radio, I heard that they were asked to reconsider, and they maintained their position. And so we still now are going, we're now back in Arkansas. We were a little ahead. I think it's the only place maybe Arkansas was a little ahead of anybody in the country. We're usually 49th or on the, and I say we now because I've been there since 2004. So that the Constitution and that the Constitution and the law has continued to act in kind of, I don't want to use a mental health term, even though I'm kind of schizophrenic. You know, it's like on the one hand it says, you know, thou shalt not. On the other hand, well, thou can, because we can't stop you. Okay? So the law has therefore been instrumental in ending racial discrimination in many areas, but it also has been instrumental in maintaining it in other areas. That disparate, we use the terms disparate as if that's kind of a neutral term, and that's like not really discrimination. It's just we got more blacks in prison, and more blacks are suffering from all kinds of health disparities, or we have more whites that are in the upper echelons of the CEOs, white males particularly. And we somehow in this 2012, and I know it started way before then, had begun to use language that makes it seem like it's neutral and it's just the way things are, and that it is okay, but that's the law has assisted us in getting there, so that, as Attorney Freeman says, we've made progress. You know, I would be totally not credible standing here if I would said we have not made progress. I'm not walking around in chains. You know, I now have a law degree from a predominantly white university, and I didn't have to sue to get in. Okay, and I'm just saying but we can look around us. So saying there has been no progress, I think, makes us not credible. But progress towards freedom is not freedom. Progress towards freedom is not freedom. And that I think many times we think freedom has come, and it hasn't, because we can continue to see the disparities. We continue to look at all of those areas of life, those indices of well-being, and we see that whites are at the top and blacks and other people of color are at the bottom. We continue to look at those indicia of dysfunction, and we see blacks are at the top and whites are at the bottom. So we look at issues of freedom, and we say, well, is this freedom? Is this somehow? And of course, many of the arguments now are, well, because the law has acted, right? Because the law has stripped legal segregation, then you must be at the bottom because something's wrong with you, right? It's no longer a systemic issue. But we know that that's not true. So we know that the ideal of equality that the courts and the legislators and the executive hold high, much like the founding fathers in Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence said, all men are created equal and imbued, imbued with the inalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet all men, they didn't mean all men, right? It was restricted in worldview and practice. It wasn't encompassing blacks, Native Americans, and other groups of color. And, of course, we know with the all men, it didn't. They meant all men, right? They didn't mean all men in the generic sense, right? Somebody told me we use men generically, and I'm wondering, well, how is men generic, right? I don't understand that. So the 13th and 14th Amendment seemed to strike a blow at this hypocrisy, ending slavery, the vestiges of slavery, and equality and inequality in treatment. Yet from the passage to Brown v. Board of Education, the equality was really an inequality. Freedom then continued to be the goal of the civil rights activists in the 1900s through the 1954 decision and until now. The promise of the 14th Amendment was finally realized in Brown, we thought. All deliberate speed, as I said earlier. However, we're still going through that all deliberate speed. We have children in integrated school systems, and our children sit in districts that are racially identifiable, primarily poor, and have insufficient resources. A major factor in another racially disparate category of the achievement gap. Okay, Central High School, for example, in Little Rock, now a nationally recognized school for its AP program, is an example of the institutional racism that has played a significant role in the achievement gap. Two schools within a school. The General High School is about 75% black, and the AP program on the other side is approximately 75% white. It's really reflective of aspects of our criminal justice system. In fact, in many communities, and I know in Little Rock, they've begun to develop this school-to-prison pipeline, right? And we're just talking about a study in Texas about the disciplinary system that was shown to be totally discriminatory. White child, black child does the same offense. White child gets a little slap on the wrist. Black child gets expelled out in the streets. What happens? That starts that school-to-prison pipeline. So it's reminiscent, then, the discrimination or the disparities, not discrimination, that we see in our schools, not just in Little Rock, it's all over the country, are reminiscent of the disparities that we see in the criminal punishment system. The crack powder cocaine movement, struggle, effort around the crack powder cocaine sentencing laws is an example. Similar situation. About 85% of those charged and convicted with possession and sale or sale of powder cocaine were white, or white. And about 85% of those convicted, charged and convicted of crack cocaine are black. Up until 2009 or 10, the sentencing was 100 to 1. That means that you had to have 100 times more powder cocaine than crack cocaine to get the same sentence. Congress, in 2009, changed it. They responded to the continuing call of the U.S. Sentencing Commission to eliminate that disparity in sentencing, that they'd had doctors and scientists after doctors and scientists saying that there was no scientific basis for the difference in treatment for that drug, cocaine, whether it be powder or crack. So Congress finally pushed, and in fact, part of the push was due to our president, Obama, and Senator Biden. Senator Biden had long been opposed to the disparity in that sentencing. They acted, and in their benevolence, they reduced it to 18 to 1. Now, why 18 to 1? I don't know. Nobody knows, but they reduced it to 18 to 1. So now you have to have 18 times more powder cocaine than crack cocaine to get the same sentence. So here we have the continuing disparity that's leading to what? In our criminal punishment system. Let's look at Arkansas. One of the first and the research project that I started when I became the director was the research project that's looking into the racial disparities in the Arkansas criminal punishment system. Arkansas is not the worst in the country, but 60% of those on death row, and they're all men, are black. 42% of those incarcerated in the prisons and jails are black. Whereas black men make up about 7.5 to 8% of the population. So, you know, we formed a steering committee, and the steering committee is made up of people, as I call it, from all around the table, because we don't want to be accused of doing the research, and then when we take it to a conservative legislature and say, you know, this is what our research showed, these are our recommendations, they say, well, you know, it's all you liberals doing that, and you probably have messed up structure, you know, research model and all of that. So we have people from all around the table. We have judges. We have chief of police from Harrison, Arkansas. You don't know Harrison, Arkansas, but it's a sundown town. And it, when I say it is, it just recently has decided it didn't want to be that. And so they're really trying to get on board and kind of erase that history. I'm not sure you can erase it, but they are. And so chief of police is on there, as well as a couple of people from another part of Harrison's structure. We have people from Northwest Arkansas, Southeast, all over the state. We have lawyers. We have judges. We have professors. We have activists, the ACLU, but we also have the conservatives. And so the reason for doing that is it is a statewide problem. There are people who have different rationales for why we have that problem, but they know it's a problem. And if we can work together and work together on the research, my hope is that we will have had buy-in from everybody so that people won't want to back out once we get the results. But we have to also have a suspension of judgment. And when I say we, I mean those of us like myself who has worked in this criminal punishment system since I got out of law school with the Department of Justice, prisoner rights, ACLU, prisoner rights, you know, who come with a bias. I have to admit it. I come with a bias. I don't think that it is somehow benign or accidental that our prisons are made disproportionately of black people, most particularly black men. There are too many studies that show that there was disparities and bias in sentencing. We have a study that was done by David Baldus, who was a well-known well-known law professor who studied the disparities in death row. Those of you who know the McCleskey v. Kim case know that his study was the basis of that case. Again, let's look at the law and the continuation of racism in our systems. The court in that case said what? They could not invalidate his study that showed that, in fact, the basic reason for the disparities on death row in Georgia, after you get rid of all of the other factors and you do all of that fancy analysis the researchers do, that the determining factor of whether or not a black man gets to death row or a white man gets to death row is race. And it's not only the race of the defendant, it's the race of the victim. So that race is the determining factor, not type of crime, not anything else. So what did the Supreme Court say? The highest court in the land. It said, we can't invalidate that. But in a footnote, it said, but if we said that this was discrimination and ruled it unconstitutional, it would turn the criminal justice system on its head. Now, isn't that a commentary on the decision of our highest court to allow this form of discrimination to continue because it would be too hard, that it would require states all over the country to really reevaluate their work, to maybe not kill anybody for a while until they really do this study and assessment, and how that study has been replicated in North Carolina, where it did at least lead to eventually a racial justice act that we tried, ACLU tried to get internationally, but they got one in North Carolina, stayed for a year, Republicans got in office. I'm not blaming the Republicans. And they couldn't get rid of it, so they watered it down. But the study has been replicated. It was replicated by Baldus in the Southeast Judicial Circuit in Arkansas. Okay? And he showed in 1985, the study has, not in 2005, I don't know why I keep saying 1985, 2005, he showed, his study showed that no white man in the Southeast, 8th Judicial Circuit in Southeast Arkansas had ever gotten capital punishment, right? Convicted of murder, but never gotten capital punishment. And that the only people who got capital punishment were black men who, surprise, surprise, killed somebody white. That was 2005, people. So we know that there's something going on. And so, and to me, it's, you know, to see the decision in 87, in fact, which some of the justices may who were there might have wanted to rethink that. I don't know. Some of them have expressed the view that they would rethink their position on the death penalty. But the law has continued, if it didn't cause, it has continued these kinds of life-limiting discrimination in our system, and in particular we see it in the criminal punishment system. Crack powder cocaine, back to that, people brought lawsuits saying that it was unconstitutional. There was only one state Supreme Court that found that it violated their state 14th Amendment. That was Minnesota in the Russell case. Judge Cahill, so many of us dearly loved, had a case, Clary v. United States. He felt, in his judicial wisdom, looking at the evidence, I mean, this was not a knee-jerk kind of judge, we all know that who knew him, that there was racial discrimination in the crack powder cocaine sentencing pattern. That it was too twisted towards race. That it was too embedded in racial terminology, in racial, not terminology, but racial impact. Because on its face, it's now, you know, the laws now have cleaned up, right? They've taken off the on its face racism, right? But even though it's not on its face, it was in fact racially discriminatory and based a lot on the statistics. So he held it unconstitutional. But the Eighth Circuit reversed him. So now we have our prisons filled. And is this where that legal requirement of intent takes another bite out of our freedom? We remember the Washington v. Davis case where the court said you can't, you know, you have to have intent. You know, you can maybe try and prove it if you can with stats, but we really don't like that. You've got to have intent. You got to find what? We have to find a smoking gun, really. That's what we have to find. When I did a case in Michigan, I found a smoking gun, right? The smoking gun was, you know, I love discovery, okay? The reason I love discovery is I love finding stuff. You know, I like finding that needle in the haystack. And I'm going through in my discovery, and I'm looking at these files from the industries, you know, and you have in the prisons, they have the electric and all of that, and men get involved in that, more so men. The women, when I did prison work, women didn't have industries, really. And I was looking through, and the question I asked the head of the electrical program there for industry was, well, why don't you have any black men working in the electrical industry. He said, because black men are afraid of electricity. I said, oh, okay. Let's highlight that in a deposition, you know. And then you had this, you know, constant in the reporting from prisoners, but also in documents, use of racial slurs, and slurs that I had never heard of. And I thought I had heard of most of them, but slurs I had never in my life heard of. But when you looked at them, I mean, when you read them, you knew it was a slur. I mean, I'm not saying it was undercover, but I just never heard of them, right? And so the rationale that the guards gave was, well, they use that term. You are a guard. You know, so luckily we had a good judge, Judge Eisen. I'm blanking on his name, something like that. He was a good judge. And when I say good judge, see, I say judges are good, not just because they agree with me. They are good if they agree with me. But because they're fair. They're willing to listen. They don't come with some predisposed opinion. And I'm probably letting the cat out of the bag, but all judges aren't like that, you know. So this judge listened, and he asked piercing questions, but not just of us, of the other side. So we won that aspect of the case. But intent has actually defeated lots of cases that were real cases. So Derrick Bell, who is now deceased, but I dearly love, I used to really disagree with him when he talked about the permanence of racism, and now I'm kind of thinking he might be right, but one of the things he said, read, and I'm reading in his in a book that was a reader compiled by Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik, he says that Southern whites rebelled against the Supreme Court's 1954 decision declaring school segregation unconstitutional precisely because they felt it endangered the long-standing priority of their superior status to blacks. But in the late 20th century, the passwords for gaining judicial recognition of the still viable property right in being white include higher entrance scores, seniority, and neighborhood schools. Consider as well the use of impossible to hurdle intent barriers to deny blacks remedies for racial injustices where the relief sought would either undermine white expectations and advantages gained during years of overt discrimination or expose the deeply embedded racism in a major institution such as the criminal justice system. The continuing significant disparities are prime examples of the structural racism that has taken front and center in maintaining the racial disparities in most indicia of well-being and dysfunction. Structural racism is really where policies and procedures are embedded now in the law that on its face doesn't say we're going to treat blacks differently or whites differently or Latinos differently. The law is what? We call it neutral on its face, right? The crack powder cocaine statute was what? It was neutral on its face. But in its application, it worked to maintain a system of racism. It worked to maintain the disproportionate numbers of blacks in prison. It works to maintain the disproportionate number of children, black children and children of color, that are at the lower levels of learning. It works to maintain the health disparities in our system. We have food deserts. Now, do you think they would have food deserts in a predominantly, overwhelmingly white area? No. They have food deserts because the predominantly, overwhelmingly white area would have a mixture of incomes, right? But they have food deserts in poor communities that are predominantly black. Because of what? It's not the law's fault. Unless, you know, we want to go to my own theory about what we should actually do to end all this, but it's not the law's fault. It's because in our system of capitalism, the big grocery stores and chains, I call them grocery stores when I was growing up, probably call them something else now, but the big chains of grocery stores and stuff, they move out of those communities. They move out of those communities. So we had in Detroit, how many of you all knew that in Detroit there was no real grocery store, no Kroger or Giant or whatever else is around in the city limits of Detroit. And so that disparity is a race disparity and is also an economic disparity, okay, poverty. So here we are, and we say, well, the racial disparities in the indicia of dysfunction, well-being and dysfunction, that the conservative institution of the law. The law is really a conservative institution. Why? Because it really is there to what? Maintain the status quo, right? The law really isn't about change. The law is about maintaining the status, but then when the status changes, when, what is that trope DeDulla says, when I'm blanking on the quote, but when the community changes, when there's a demand for change, when we pass another, legislator passes another law, then the courts will enforce it. So to maintain the status quo from slavery to today, where we continue to see a deeply divided country on issues of race, where appellate judges feel free to pass on racially debasing characterizations of the President of the United States, where the 14th Amendment was seen as a major tool to end inequality, has in fact been used to maintain inequality by being applied in ahistorical ways to maintain white supremacy, reverse discrimination. This is not an argument for the mean-spirited discrimination that was designed to maintain white supremacy and some of the privileges that whites had, or to allow those who are victims of that, but to allow those who are victims of that forced anti-competitiveness an opportunity to be equal in treatment and, in fact, to be free. That forced anti-competitiveness that existed for 500 years in this society. And I'm quoting, the forced anti-competitiveness is a professor, Lu Anne Wang, at law school at University of Pittsburgh. So I don't know if Professor Salsius remembers and or even knew the light bulb that was turned on in my head in his property class. I learned that when the Europeans came to the Americas, to the home of the Native Americans, they created the concept of ownership in a land that occupants had a view of community. And so the worldview of community was then displaced and the view of ownership, individual ownership, was imposed so that the legality of the Native Americans' use of the land could be challenged. And it was used to legitimize their genocide. Now, he didn't tell me all that. I just kind of took what he told me, and then I went the next step. Because, you know, he was a good professor. He wasn't going to try and, you know, imbue me with some political perspective. But he did tell me that the concept of ownership was a creation, and it was used to have disownership, or not even ownership, to disengage Native Americans from their land, from the land as they used it in community. So that if we look at the use of the law in the United States, we can see that it has done some good. Can't say it hasn't, but it has also done some things to maintain the inhumanity and brutalities of racism in our country. And so what we have to do, it seems to me, if we're really going to have freedom, if we're really going to be free, have freedom, racial justice, is we have to do something that's very hard. And especially very hard for white people, and I'll just be blunt, is that we have to be willing to look at privilege. We have to be willing to look at those things that maintain this disparity. And we have to do what Dr. Raines talked about earlier, and we'll talk some to you about now, is that we have to be willing to really dig down and pull up the roots of racism in this society. And that's going to be painful, but it can be done. And I want to close with the quote from Derrick Bell. The cost of racial discrimination is levied against us all. Blacks feel the burden and strive to remove it. Too many whites have felt that it was in their interest to resist those freedom efforts. That temptation, despite the counterindicators provided by history, logic, and simple common sense, remains strong. but the efforts to achieve racial justice have already performed a miracle of transforming the Constitution, a document primarily intended to protect property rights, into one that provides a measure of protection for those whose rights are not bolstered by wealth, power, and property. Thank you.
Before we hear from Dr. Raines, we're going to take a 15-minute break. And